Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Len Goodman, professor of philosophy and Andrew Mellon professor of humanities, about his soon-to-be-published book, Religious Pluralism and Values in the Public Sphere. Len, thanks for being willing to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure. I'm delighted to know about your interest, Chris.
Great. So start off with a relatively general question, which is, what has led you to write a book about religious pluralism and values in the public sphere at this particular time? What's at stake with regard to these issues?
Well, let me start from the what has led me side. Mm-hmm. I think I've always been interested in the question of how do diverse perspectives about truth, about values, about the way we should live, connect with one another. Obviously, religion lies at the heart of those issues and concerns for many of us, whether we're religious or not. I think a lot of people invest their deepest concerns and their most important values where they understand religion to lie, and that's one of the things that differentiates religions with one another. As far as why now, I think we're living in times of great religious interaction. We've seen a lot of globalization. We work together. The world has become today sort of like the way Alexandria was in the Hellenistic period. People rubbing shoulders, doing business together, attending one another's family and community events, and wondering that other religion, what's it all about? Sometimes people study other religions than their own. Sometimes people don't know very much about the religious heritage in which they themselves come from. I'm interested in dialogue, and I'm interested in the possibility of a mutual understanding and the need that we have to prevent mutual misunderstanding.
Hmm. Now, you're adamant in distinguishing pluralism from relativism and skepticism. So,
yes.
Could you define what you mean by pluralism and why you think these other ideas, relativism and skepticism, have become so attractive as alternatives?
Well, I think one of the things that makes both relativism and skepticism attractive is that people think that they represent one or the other, or sometimes both combined. Relativism and or skepticism represent some kind of high road to tolerance, and we all know the importance of connecting with one another and appreciating one another and valuing one another's perspectives. The trouble is that there's little false advertising in that conception. Skepticism is a refusal to take seriously truth claims. Very often, it can be radical skepticism, refusing to take any truth claim seriously, but usually it focuses on particular truth claims about religion or truth claims about values, dismissing those ideas wholesale. I think there are two problems with it. One is that it's not a way of showing respect for others, and the other is that it's often based on a kind of self-deception. People kid themselves. They hold to themselves the values that they're still going to take seriously, the truth claims that they themselves want to make, so people will be skeptical about what they consider superstitious or what they consider overboard or across the line, but very uncritical about other notions. So there's an unquestioning sort of bias in the application of what one is skeptical about and how far one carries one's skepticism. Now, relativism tends to go to the opposite extreme. It wants to pretend that all claims are true and all are equally valid. Well, to make them all equally valid is to make none of them worth anything. You pretend to embrace everything, and you wind up dismissing everything because people, after all, disagree. And the relativist has no way of saying that anybody in any of those disputes is any more right or any more wrong than anybody else. So I think that relativism, intending to be tolerant, winds up to be, at best, patronizing. What do I mean by pluralism? By pluralism, I mean not that there are multiple realities or multiple conflicting truths, but that there are different legitimate perspectives, different beliefs. I think that a pluralist hasn't thrown away the responsibility to use judgment about what claims are worth considering and what claims are worth taking seriously, but and is willing to allow that different people might reasonably reach different conclusions or different modes of life and practices, because religions aren't just about beliefs, after all. But pluralists take a live-and-let-live approach, which is what the original motivation behind skepticism and relativism often turns out to be. That is, there is a tolerance there, but a tolerance that doesn't involve saying, I'm right, you're right, they're all right, and anybody who comes along and says, well, how can you say such a thing? Oh, you're right, too.
Now, you've kind of alluded to this already, but I wanted to ask you to go into it in a little more detail. You argue there are three ways that people deal with religious differences, and you call them...
Three bad ways.
Okay, that's true.
Save the good way for ourselves.
Three ways you don't agree with, that's right. And you call one balkanize, another baudelarize, and a third patronize.
Yes.
Balkanize, I mean, a quick way of hopefully not incorrectly summarizing it is arguing that faith and practice are separate and that belief should just be left alone because, after all, it's just belief. Baudelarize is suggesting all religions are pretty much the same. And patronize is recognizing difference but romanticizing that difference. So I wonder if you could... actually talk a little bit more in a little bit more detail about each one of these and where you see the problems over and above what you've already said.
Thank you. And I will say you didn't oversimplify it at all. I appreciate and respect the fact that if this were a book review, you'd be getting to the point of saying, Chris actually read the book and understood it well. Let me mention balkanize first. That was the term I threw at this radical distinction of faith from practice. It was a useful distinction, especially, let's say, in the 17th century when there were a lot of disputes between and among Christians in particular. Christianity and Islam are both religions that put faith at the center of religious devotion and piety, and there were legitimate concerns. You can see it in Gulliver's Travels, where there have been long and bloody wars among Lilliputians over which end of the egg to crack first, the big Indians versus the little Indians. And there's a kind of a bitter Swiftian satire there. My God, are we killing people over that sort of thing and torturing them and ripping their hearts out? And that's the kind of thing that was going on. That's a legitimate historical issue, unfortunately still a living issue indeed. However, religious differences, I would maintain, are not just differences of faith. Many religions are deeply invested in practices as well. Religions make moral claims and ritual claims upon the lives of their adherents, social claims and political claims. In fact, the claim to religious freedom is one of them. And that often involves religious practices, whether it's a matter of Native Americans using their sweat lodge ceremonies and smoking certain substances, or you could think of countless religious practices which are expressions of faith. The idea that ritual being merely the ornament of faith is a little too dismissive to be a realistic description of the way we live our spiritual lives. I think that the desire to compartmentalize religion and say religion is only what one does one day of the week, only that what one does with a certain portion of one's mind and had nothing to do with what one does with one's body or one's spouse or one's children. I think that's a terrible oversimplification. I think we have to recognize that religions are not quite as neutered as that, and if we're going to come to terms with our own religious practices and beliefs and those of others, We've got to start from the recognition that religion is a matter of action and not just a matter of thought about issues which parenthetically are assumed to be issues that don't really matter in the real practical world. So that's why I called that reliance on faith and religion. It's dismissive in a way. Faith and practice. Faith is just a matter of what you believe, and what you believe doesn't hurt me, so you can believe whatever you like, I don't care. I think that's pulling the wool over our own eyes about what religious observance really amounts to. As for bowdlerizing, as you said, what I have in mind there is the notion that all religions are really seeking the same goal, involved in the same quest. If you define what that quest is about in very, very generic terms, you can indeed iron out a lot of the differences. But I think that insofar as religions are an intellectual and spiritual exercise and practice and enterprise, institution, they may be asking different questions. I give an example in the book about Hinduism and Buddhism, for example, which Hinduism is asking about why it is that people suffer and trying to explain that suffering in terms of karma. Buddhism looks at that quest very quizzically, very critically, very skeptically, and says, you know, the source of suffering is unwillingness to let go. The source of suffering is the desire to attain or to achieve. And the secret of overcoming suffering is a form of renunciation. That's a terrible oversimplification of Buddhism. But notice right. that the question the Buddhist is asking himself and trying to solve is not the same as the question that's asked by a person who's seeking, let's say, personal immortality or salvation, as many a Christian is, whether through faith or through practices. The quest for immortality that a Christian might be interested in is, in a way, the opposite sort of thing from the quest for release, which the Hindu is seeking and which the Buddhist is seeking to attain by discovering that there isn't any substantiality to the soul. That's a very, very different sort of matter. If you look at Judaism and Christianity side by side, you see a Christian pursuing salvation or hoping for the grace to be accorded salvation, and you see the Jew trying to sanctify this life rather than escape from it or find a better one. That's a difference in problematics. They're not really asking the same question, so the fact that they're coming up with different answers is not too surprising, and one can't really sort of put them all into the same hat and fish them around and think that they're all going to come out the same. By patronizing, yes, there's an admission of differences there, but there's a tendency to romanticize the exotic, and that turns into a form of patronization. You see this with certain forms of mysticism, whether it's the attitude that people have in a popular form, attitude towards a popular form of Zen, let's say, which was very popular in the 50s, or towards Rumi today and Sufism. Attracted to these things without necessarily being willing to submit to the discipline and the rigors of the life that a serious Sufi or a serious Zen acolyte would be submitting to. They look at the froth and the frosting on the cake, but they don't really investigate where it's going and what it's about. So that's an attempt to unify everything, or in the case of that patronizing move, an attempt to regard it as quaint and charming and maybe a little distant from what we cold and rational people might be engaged in, but something that in essence we're not taking seriously, or if we do take it seriously, it's a kind of a put-on, it's a kind of an act that one indulges in, a kind of costume wearing or pretense. I don't think that that's the high road to pluralism, which would involve recognizing and understanding the problematics and concerns and practices of the other as being genuinely other, genuinely different, maybe something that one disagrees with, maybe something that one rejects, maybe values that one can't take seriously and doesn't have to sort of stroke them nicely on the forehead and say, isn't that nice?
Well, that's an excellent segue to the next question that I wanted to ask, which is, you write that, and this is a quote, pluralism demands both charity and clarity. And you follow through on the clarity portion of that injunction a few pages later when you say that, quote, religions can have illnesses, even cancers. Some religious practices and beliefs are genuinely evil and no less genuinely religious for that, unquote. So, I mean, you could ask a lot of questions out of that particular section of the book, but what I was curious about was, how does someone who comes out of a particular tradition hold this view of other traditions without appearing to be judgmental, claiming to have a sort of a God's eye view of things? I wonder, is it a matter of criticism beginning at home, which is something that you talk a little bit about? If so, with criticism beginning at home, you know, do you ever actually leave home and have the ability to move out, wander abroad, criticizing others if there is a lot going on in your own religious home?
I think, Yeah, that's a great question. I think it does have to begin at home. I think one has to know how to criticize one's own religion. But, you know, in the religion I come from, which is Judaism, self-criticism is endemic. And there are lots of people who are better at criticizing their own religious tradition than they are at studying it or knowing it. It depends on what the culture, what the ethos is. There are religions around today where you can get yourself in an awful lot of trouble for making any criticism. I read a piece in today's New York Times by Wendy Doniger, whose book has been suppressed in India because she's exhibiting to people a side of Hinduism that Hindu nationalists don't like to hear about. She's not a Hindu herself, but she's one of the world's most serious scholars of Hindu texts. She's telling about some texts, and she gets a certain joy out of it, I'm sure. But she's telling about certain texts that many traditional Hindus don't know much about, and that she thinks would be of interest both to Hindus and to Westerners to know something about. I think that cross-cultural studies are a great benefit. Not only to the outsider who wants to study seriously another tradition, as I've devoted much of my time since the 1960s studying Islam, as much a benefit to the outsider as they are to the insider who might not really have a college level understanding, let alone further research into the primary texts and traditions of their own religious culture. It's very difficult, but it's very critical to see yourself in another's eyes. And it's an important responsibility for people to study one another's traditions fairly, not patronizingly, critically, with an open mind. One doesn't have to be an apologist of another person's tradition or to try to remake it. I quoted a passage in the book by Van Inwagen, a wonderful passage where he says, you know, if somebody's version of Islam doesn't happen to agree with my middle class values or my Buddhist values or whatever, that doesn't mean that that's not essential to Islam. Let's let the Muslim theologians decide what's essential to Islam and not clean it up for them. I think that passage that you read, that line that you read from the book, was intended as a reference to 9/11. And I think what we need to recognize is that the hijackers on 9/11 did not hijack Islam. Islam was not the victim there. Those men were serious, devout, pious Muslims who were prepared to give their lives to murder a lot of people. And that was a religious act for them. And not every religious act is appropriate. Not every religious act is legitimately regarded as holy. And I think we need to speak out about that. I would like to see more Muslims speaking out about that. I would like to see overt and explicit condemnation of acts of that kind by Muslim leaders who should be saying not simply this was un-Islamic, but this is the wrong way to try to live your Islam. This is the wrong way to try to exhibit and act on your faith. We haven't seen enough of that. I've written an article on that subject in the journal Political Theology, those who'd like to read more about what I had to say about that. But I feel very vehemently about that. You raised the question, is it being judgmental to look askance at actions or positions or traditions that are sincerely done in the name of one's faith tradition, and to say, you know, if that's what your faith tradition is, there's something wrong with it. It needs work. We see, just to refer to another matter of current events, the Pope came out with a statement, I guess it was yesterday, about the way the Church has handled the various forms of sexual exploitation that have been that have occurred. The fact that they've occurred is probably not that unusual. The fact that they've been covered up is very, very serious. And he made a kind of balanced statement. It's terrible that these things happen, but we're the only ones who've really investigated these things, and we other institutions aren't getting after it the way we have been. And he lost a lot of spiritual ground when he made that statement. Yes, it should have been serious and committed Catholics, the Pope in the lead of all of them, to say, we don't condone, we have condoned, and we're not going to condone any longer. That's his position as a moral and spiritual leader, and I think as a spiritual leader, he has been in many areas already a very important spiritual leader. When the Pope came into office, in my speculative opinion, even before he came into office, he made a commitment to clean up the Vatican Bank. That has been a center of money laundering, which involves drugs, slavery, and terrorism for decades. And he made a commitment to clean up the Vatican Bank, and he's working on that. That's the kind of thing that our religious leaders need to do in all of our religions. If we have a problem, yes, we have to look at it first in our own traditions, but we have no obligation to close our eyes to the serious problems that exist in other religions. And in a way, it's helpful because people can then say, look at the image that we're presenting to the world of what our religion represents. We've got to do something about that. Let me speak for a moment from the Jewish standpoint. When a person, the Christian expression would be a person of faith, but when a person who is regarded as wise and learned in Torah does some action or fails to do some action, and the example they like to give is paying your bills promptly. You bought something, did you pay for it promptly? When a person who has the reputation of being in that kind of position acts with something less, anything less than exemplary generosity and concern, that is labeled in Talmudic law as Chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name. If you analyze what that means God's name is God's reputation. It gives God a bad reputation when a person who is regarded as devoted to God does something which is less than exemplary of what spirituality ought to be standing for. That, I think, is the standard we should apply to ourselves, and I don't see any reason why we should not apply the same standard to one another. I stress that can be helpful to those voices within a tradition. And Islam is very notable because those voices need to be encouraged. They are under the gun. Very, very helpful to those voices within a tradition who need and want to be able to speak out.
I think we're going to turn a little bit towards another section of the book, which is related, but in which you focus particularly on one thinker. But before I ask about that, I did want to ask a question about how you see the role of the state in fostering religion, because it's at one point you you say that their religious pluralism has a way forward. It involves humility, study, debate, but also the activities of the state. So how does the state come into play?
Right. When I set about to write this book, I had two sorts of issues in mind, Chris. One was, how does a serious individual who is engaged in a religious tradition and takes that tradition very seriously, how does that person relate to other religions that he or she does not subscribe to or follow, but yet wants to take seriously? And my belief is that we can learn from one another. This is something that has happened historically over time. We don't have to subscribe to everything, which means, in practice, subscribing to nothing. But the other side of it, the public side of that, that was the private side. The public side of it was, how does what relationship should the state have to religious institutions, religious practices, religious beliefs, rituals, etc. And where the individual needs always to define himself or herself spiritually, morally, and so forth, vis-a-vis the various alternatives that present themselves, the state, in a way, has greater latitude, because every state today is de facto pluralist. There is no state that doesn't have a variety of formal and informal, institutional and non-institutional conventions and convictions and individuals within it, and movements and groups, and this is all very dynamic. This has probably been a feature of human society from the outset, but it's very pronounced in our globalized times. So states have to have policies about this. They have to have laws about how to do this sort of thing. And here's an area where public pluralism becomes very important, in my view. You alluded to the fact that I think that the state should be supporting religious enterprise, and I think that's right. I think it should. I think the way in which a state does that, there's some variety. Europeans do it one way, Americans do it another way. If one recognizes that we don't want a society of isolated, insulated individuals who have no communal connection with one another, no faith connection with one another, no connection to the past or the future that religious institutions create and perpetuate. We have to recognize that religion is an asset to the state, in the sense that it addresses moral and intellectual and spiritual concerns that the state has no skill in dealing with and no legitimate role in interfering with. The kind of way that kind of support should be given, in my opinion, is best based on the eleemosynary model. That is to say, when individuals affiliate, they, as happens in this country, you pay your dues to your religious organization, and that's tax deductible. Hmm. You don't join, you don't pay. So there's an indirect subsidy from the state. The assumption is that those funds were used for some good purpose, but it could be a good purpose that the state itself, in principle, can't and shouldn't be involved in. And the funding in that case is proportioned to the extent to which people actually do commit and do feel involved. So there's a kind of liberty of conscience exercised there. I think that's a good model. It has a downside. I want to specify part of the downside is that it leads to a kind of commodification of religion, and people religious religious ministers may pander. You know, it leads to the spiritual equivalent of grade inflation. If you have everybody depending on student evaluations, that proves to be a factor in grade inflation, and similarly with religions. But although we have to pay a price, I think the eleemosynary model is a pretty good model. But I do think that not everything that calls itself a religion is a religion, and not everything that is a religion legitimately deserves that kind of support. The default position should be hands off, but when you get cultish institutions, which are characterized by their desire for mind control, which want to take over people's lives and make their decisions for them, and some of the popular cults have done this. They take over people's bank accounts, and they take over people's conscience, and they start telling you, "Oh, you've got to divorce your wife." We know what these organizations are, and they have gamed the system. And I think that societies, through their institutions, which are states, need to be able to protect themselves and protect their people from that kind of invasive institution. The fear of being judgmental has led many in the religious studies profession to feel that they're unable to specify what the distinction is between a religious group, a religious sect, a religion, a new religion, and a cult. I think that the key is that matter of mind control. That's going to call for judgment, but I think judgment is appropriate in a situation like that.
Now, the relationship between the state and religion is something that John Rawls takes up, and yes, and you take up John Rawls in a good portion of the book. So I wonder if you could talk at first a little bit about who John Rawls is for folks who are not familiar with his work, and what he thinks the role of religious belief is in the public sphere, and how he gets to that.
Sure.
Gets to that view.
John Rawls was a Harvard philosopher, born in 1921, died in 2002. It's about 12 years ago he died. He played a very important role in American philosophy, particularly in the realm of political philosophy. Before Rawls came around, a lot of people in political studies in general thought that Machiavelli had really put political science on the right footing by describing it as a value-free, or creating an ambiance which let political scientists think of their work as a kind of value-free inquiry into political behavior. The last thing one wanted to do in political studies was to make any normative judgments. I think partly as a result of Watergate, Americans became sensitized to the notion that, we really need to be doing ethics. I recall in the aftermath of Watergate, there was a lot of claim that we in the colleges should be teaching ethics. I'm not sure any more than Aristotle was that that's the way ethics gets taught. Aristotle told his students, if your parents didn't teach you how to be an ethical person, you've come to the wrong place here. I'm going to teach you how ethics works, but I can't make you an ethical person. This is something which is done by parents and peers and social institutions and ethos and structure. But there was a great call in the aftermath of Watergate for something to be done so that people would have some kind of ethical standards. And Rawls work, his famous book, A Theory of Justice, rode the crest of that wave. Rawls was situated at Harvard. He had been thinking about the nature of justice at least since the 50s. And when he published A Theory of Justice, he wrote a book which had the effect of making people feel that it was okay again to use normative judgments. There was a time at the high water mark of positivism in American academe when if somebody said to you, "Oh, that's a value judgment," that was a conversation stopper. You made a value judgment. You know, that was an illicit move. It was worse than a foul in basketball. You were off the court. We're always making value judgments. That's something that humans do. I think I remarked in the course of that book that just about all of our language is value laden. Even the conjunctions. The thing that Rawls did was he came up with a way of recasting John Locke's ideas from back in the 17th century. Locke had argued that a just society would be one that people contractually agreed to. And Rawls understood that notion of a contract, a social contract, which has biblical roots. Rawls understood that didn't refer to a historical contract, and he proposed a model in which it was a virtual contract. What is it that people would agree to in a very interesting circumstance, which he called under the veil of ignorance? What would people agree to if they were free and rational, uncoerced and undefrauded, trying to set up some basic rules under which they would be governed, but didn't know what position they themselves would occupy in the society that they were organizing? And he came up with two conclusions about what people would agree to under those circumstances. The first was that they would not want to give up their basic freedoms to structure the society that they were in. That was the basic liberty principle. In a way, you could see the elegance of it in the notion. When the genie offers you three wishes, and the first wish is to have more wishes, people don't want to give up their freedom. And the second principle that he thought people would stipulate behind what he called the veil of ignorance was a basic equality principle. Some people, namely socialists, think that a society is unjust if everybody isn't getting the same. Rawls was not a socialist, he was a liberal. And his view was that if there are to be any inequalities of goodies or of risks, then the only thing that people would expect to justify those inequalities was that the existence of the inequality would benefit those who proved to be least advantaged in the way things worked out. So, because one could always envision oneself as belonging to that least advantaged class of people. He assumed that there would be classes of people. He assumed that that those classes had interests of their own. He assumed that the goodies and baddies had to do with material goods, etc. And Walls' work was seen by many, many people as very liberative, because it liberated them to make value judgments about political issues once again. One symptom of the fact that Rawls himself was operating in an environment where positivism had been very strong and value judgments had been very much verboten for a long, long time was that although he professed to be doing normative ethics, and he even described himself as a follower of Immanuel Kant in this regard, much of his argumentation about what people would choose under the veil of ignorance was predicated on the assumption that the results that he reached are what we would call justice. In other words, he was grounding it in an empirical claim about what a consensus was with regard to the nature of justice. In that sense, his argument was more descriptive than prescriptive, as it was so often celebrated for being. Now, as a liberal, Rawls found himself under a little criticism as communitarianism in particular, and a recognition of multiculturalism gradually gained sway. And he wrote two more important books. He wrote a lot of stuff, but he wrote two more important books, and it's with those I have critical things to say about all three major works, but my focus, as far as religious pluralism is concerned, is more on those latter two books. One was called Political Liberalism, and the other was called Law of Peoples. In Political Liberalism, Rawls wanted to come to terms with the fact that societies are, as I said, de facto pluralistic. People made the criticism that the assumptions that he was making about what rational choosers would freely choose if they didn't know what positions they would occupy in the long run were assumptions based on a certain notion of what rationality involves. He packed his notion of rationality with a very secular understanding, and he packed his notion of equality with a very, shall we say, materialistic kind of understanding. So if your chief concern in life was nobility or honor or shame or chivalry or piety or who knows.
You have quite a list in the book.
I have a list. I could easily list 100 of them. Rawls wasn't really thinking that that's what he meant by rationality. So there's a certain amount of cultural load that the notion of rationality he uses carries, and the effect of that is that people were saying, you know, this is kind of ethnocentric. This is kind of it's supposed to be normative stuff, but it sounds like he's just justifying the society that he already lives in and the little circle of people that he associates with, and this is what a small group of his friends might agree to, although even among his friends there were some pretty serious disagreements. Robert Nozick, for example, who was his colleague and his friend, didn't agree with him at all about the equality principle, because it involved a certain amount of redistribution, and it involved the assumption that what you've got is mainly a matter of good fortune rather than merit or effort or any other kind of dessert. In trying to take account of cultural differences, Rawls came up against an old bugbear of his, because as a very young man, we learned later in life, as a very young man, he had been pretty serious about religion, and he had written something about it as a kid. And he was one of these people you often meet who's a sort of recovering religious person. and and people like that have certain allergies and immune responses that they display, and Rawls figured when he started to deal with cultural diversity, rather than look at it from the standpoint of the reality of community and the way communities do things that formal institutions like the state can't do, he wanted to take seriously the phenomenon of religion, but he didn't want to have to have values like that mucking up the scheme. Keep that to your own private sphere. And so he came up with a proposal, and this time he was being pretty normative, in political liberalism, and he named his proposal by the same title as the book, Political Liberalism, that if you had any comprehensive doctrine, which he defined as a religious view or a metaphysical view, a view about the ultimate nature of reality or about the ultimate character of things, if you had any scriptural values or any metaphysical values, you had no business bringing them up in any deliberations about the basic rules of a society that you lived in. And here he wasn't just talking about the veil of ignorance anymore. He was talking about going to vote and sitting there in the ballot box, standing there in the ballot box, and trying to decide how to vote on a given initiative or referendum or a given candidate. If you had any religious motivations or any metaphysical motivations, by which he meant, I specify, motivations about comprehensive view about the nature of things, You have a moral obligation to exclude those from your deliberation. You shouldn't be bringing those up in conversation, which is a deliberative nature. You shouldn't be allowing those things to influence you. It's the kind of thing that sometimes in a jury case, if some juror might get disqualified because he says he doesn't believe in capital punishment, or he does believe in capital punishment, or whatever, because it says so in the Bible, that kind of thing is supposed to be verboten, according to Rawls, and I argue in trying to take on what he says there, that that's a very impractical an intrusive approach, that it leads to the opposite of liberalism. I think it's Orwellian to call that liberalism, and putting the adjective political onto liberalism doesn't make it any less intrusive. You can't get into people's conscience. The fact is that most people articulate their most seriously held norms in religious terms, in terms derived from scripture and other components of a religious tradition that they hold very sacred. And it is impractical, at best, to try and exclude those concerns from public discourse. To successfully do so is worse than impractical. That is oppressive. That's telling people not only what they should think, but what they should do about what they think. What I advocated in religious pluralism and values in the public sphere is that society should be open to hearing from various religious traditions and learning from what they have to say. And if their arguments make sense, whether they're scriptural or not, whether they're metaphysical or not, they deserve a place at the table, and I mean the deliberative table, where we're actually talking about how we should live and how we can live with one another. It seems to me that's the right way to respect people's views and people's values. And I make a point about metaphysics, which I think is rather important. Metaphysics has historically served as a kind of glue, a kind of connective tissue between the poetry in which religious insights and inspiration are very often expressed, and the and the more secular, allegedly, professedly practical and pragmatic views. Metaphysics allows the translation of religious ideas into secular terms, or more universal terms. The fact that they're universal should not make them suspect, as Rawls claims that it should. Mm-hmm. Metaphysics becomes suspect because it professes to know something about everything. Well, there are people who do know a little something about everything. Those people are called wise or sages or prophets, and their advice should not be authoritative. I don't think that we should have sort of a nocturnal council of the wise or some body like they have in Iran, which is going to tell the government what it may or may not do. I think that would be dreadful. But to have those opinions expressed, and those symbols and stories and norms enunciated, I think this is very wholesome. One more point before we leave that one. I notice that people who agree with Rawls on the inappropriateness of religious counsels and advice on questions of abortion or euthanasia or gambling or pornography or you name it, they're not as critical of religious voices when it comes to matters of the environment or slavery or Jim Crow. There are situations where religious voices have been welcomed. And I don't think that the American Civil War would have gone the way it did had it not been for the fact that there were people who had powerful religious objections to the institution of slavery. There were also people who had powerful religious claims in support of slavery, and we need to evaluate those things, but we can't have that conversation if the religious voices are silenced, as Rawls urges that they should be. The good thing about it is that it's extremely unlikely to happen. If Rawls's suasions were to take hold, the net effect would be that people would disguise their religious claims in other terms. And that would lead to a kind of hypocrisy and a kind of subterfuge, a kind of Aesopian language, which would produce just the opposite of the kind of openness that an open society should be encouraging and would be profiting from.
You've indicated in what you've been saying that you are proposing a vision of how religious pluralism should function in the public sphere, and as part of that, you propose what you call minima and maxima in terms of moral standards for society. And you write that, quote, both the minima and the maxima I am mooting presume the inestimable worth of personhood. The minima seek to curb its violation. The maxima inscribe some ways in which human dignity can be fostered, unquote. I wanted to talk a little bit about the minima and maxima and start by asking you a little bit more about what you mean by the inestimable worth of personhood, and what are the grounds for you of presuming presuming that as the basis.
Okay. Again, a very good question, but that's a very tough question to answer because the inestimable worth of personhood for me is rock bottom. I don't want grounds for that.
Okay.
You know, there are always going to be political leaders who think that it's very good that they should have a lot of people in their population because then they have more troops. And I think we always have to be careful about keeping our values right side up. I think the value of the person is the core here. Mm. That's the foundation. And part of my liberalism is that I think that what that means and how that dignity is used and not abused is something that that's what liberty is all about. That's where we express and develop and elaborate our own personhood. So I'm not gonna ground it on something else.
Uh-huh.
You know, that it would be good for the economy if people were more free or something like that. You know, so keep the tickety boom. Keep the wheels of the economy going. No. People don't exist for the sake of the economy. The economy exists for the sake of the people. I can, however, say a little more about. I can put some flesh on those
mm-hmm.
bones
mm-hmm.
by saying, constitutively, what I think the preservation and enhancement of human dignity and worth amount to, in so doing, I can also fire a couple of backhand volleys back at Rawls, and I'll tell you how. For example, I think that there should be parks. I think that there should be libraries. I think that there should be public education, including public higher education. Why? Because that helps people to enhance their understanding of themselves and one another and their world. I think that it's worthwhile for people to enjoy themselves. I think it's worthwhile for people to get out and see nature, and to learn and to have observatories and to have access to the internet, et cetera, et cetera. I think these are public responsibilities.
Hmm.
Now, here's the backhand at Rawls. If I say any of these things and somebody says, you're saying that public monies should be expended on such things, let alone health, which should be included there too.
Hmm.
You're saying that public monies should be expended on these things. Isn't that a pretty basic constitutional kind of issue? If you say that because you believe in the inestimable value of the human person, aren't you predicating your proposal about how public money should be spent on some comprehensive notion? That's what, that's what Rawls wants to rule out,
mm-hmm.
right? We don't want to base it on comprehensive notions. If I were to say we should have national parks because it's good for the economy in the areas surrounding the national parks, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I don't go on to say that what's good for the economy is good in absolute terms, because then I've got back into metaphysics. But if I say what's good for people, that I would rather live in a society of educated people than in a society where people are not so well educated, That, to me, is an expression of a metaphysical claim that I place value on personhood for its own sake. And it goes right down the line. And I say the same thing about parks that I said before about religious institutions. These are things that enhance the individuality and the community that we live in. It seems to me is a value worth pursuing. Hmm. If I look at the minima, mm-hmm. and I mentioned the prohibition of slavery. Mm-hmm. They tell me that we have 27 million slaves in the world today. If I look at trafficking that's connected with that, and the exploitation, the enforced prostitution, the child warriors, if I look at genocide, if I look at genital cutting, there are an awful lot of practices that I can say that is wrong. Mm-hmm. That is wrong. There is never a condition where it's right to rape somebody. We read in the paper a couple times just in recent weeks about village councils in India punishing somebody. She was going with a fellow that the community didn't approve with, and the judge in the tribal council ordered her to be gang raped. There's never a condition where it's right to rape somebody. I can point to these things, and I can point to them as being wrong. And if you ask me, how do you know that those things are wrong? Isn't there a gray area? Aren't you being Manichaean, black and white? No, it's not a gray area. And the way that I know that it's wrong is that it's a violation of someone's personhood. Hmm. So that can, as I said, put a little flesh mm-hmm. on these bones. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking in abstractions when I'm talking about human dignity. But that's the minimal end of it.
Right.
And when I talk about education and spirituality or athletics or the experience of nature or the experience of art, those are the open-ended, diverse. You know, not everybody's going to be a concert violinist. Not everybody's going to enjoy the opera. But there are people whose lives are opened up by the fact that they enjoy the opera. Do you remember the movie Moonstruck, where the Cher character takes the I want to say it wasn't Sylvester Stallone, but it was a fellow like that. She takes him to the opera and she realizes what a wonderful guy he is because she's taking him to see La Boheme, and she turns around and looks at him and he's got tears in his eyes. He gets it. He's grown. He's experienced something that he didn't know about before. And she sees this humanity, which the guy always had, but she sees that humanity blossoming because he has allowed himself an emotional experience which isn't about the fact that he once experienced an injury in the bakery where he works. That's the kind of flourishing that I think is the open-ended, the positive side, the maximal side of our humanity.
Right. Now, the maxima that you particularly mention in your book are the Ten Commandments.
I gave them as examples.
Right. Examples and others could propose other maxima. And in fact, you've been kind of proposing some others.
Definitely.
Right here. Yeah. How do you see, and this will be our last question.
We've got to do the international thing, though.
Oh.
Oh, we've got to write it.
Oh, okay. You wanted to talk? Okay. Let's do the, let's do this one, and then we'll do the international one. How do you see moral maxima operating in the public sphere? Now, I was thinking, you know, in terms of the Ten Commandments, but as you're talking about things here, I can begin to see, I think, a little bit more.
You can see why I'm calling it pluralistic.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if I'm thinking the Ten Commandments, I'm thinking, well, how do the Ten Commandments play a part in how people act or behave, or how do they become part of the flourishing of people in the public square?
Wonderful.
Square.
Wonderful. Yeah. I think what I have to say here is that there's a premise there. There's an assumption that I'm making, and the assumption is this: if you're talking minima, the minima that I introduced are meant to be universal, not universally practiced, not universally respected, but universally acceptable. Slavery is always wrong. Rape is always wrong. That sort of thing. Those are minima. They're pan-human universals. If you want to talk about maxima, they've got to be culturally situated. And that's the reason I chose the Ten Commandments. Because the Ten Commandments don't exist just by themselves. And I said, readers will point the readers at that satirical ending of the chapter where I quoted Yip Harburg's lyrics. But I'm not gonna tell those who are listening. I have to look at the book and see what Yip Harburg had to do with it. But it's not going to do you any good to put them up as a plaque on the courthouse. That's an icon. We got lots of icons that people don't pay much attention to. There was a time when the eagle on the standard of the Roman legions was a symbol of Zeus, of Jupiter. And people took that very seriously. As that symbol got secularized, it became meaningless. Hawaiians, I mentioned in the book, find it very objectionable when Ku, the god of war, is made into some kind of plastic resin tiki torch thing. This is something that their culture takes very seriously. You don't just turn it into a cigarette lighter or a tiki torch. The Ten Commandments on a courthouse wall is just one more thing for people to ignore. The Ten Commandments as part of your life is part of a larger fabric which doesn't come by itself any more than your heart comes by itself. Your heart is part of your whole organism. The Ten Commandments is part of the fabric of a life. So I'll focus on one of them. Focus on the one about the Sabbath. People who observe the Sabbath find that it infuses their whole life with a kind of spirituality. And that's not the only kind of spirituality, and that's not the only way of infusing your life with spirituality, but it's one way. So when I speak of these, of this Decalogue as being embedded in a way of life, according to Jewish tradition, there are 613 commandments in the five books of Moses, and all of them are intended and portended by the Ten Commandments. So what it means to honor your father and mother, and what it means to not covet, the whole system, above all, what it means in the first commandment to live with God. These are important religious norms that infuse the rest of your life. That's why they're maxima. Other cultures, other traditions, other religions have their own ways of articulating their values and making them part of people's lives. And you can see one of the reasons I was objecting to the notion of, you know, faith is over here and practice is something else. Faith and practice go together. And try and separate them. Faith without practice is hypocrisy. Practice without faith was mechanism. It's a living relationship. Yes, other traditions will do it in other ways. And when they do, if one has a pluralistic outlook, one looks at those ways and is there something we can learn from them? Is there some way that in which what I'm doing doesn't look good to them? Maybe I should consider it again. That's the kind of thing that pluralism should encourage.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we need to talk about international.
Okay,
that's fine. Sure. So yeah, and this is
obviously any questions that haven't been answered in this conversation must already be completely answered in the book. Yeah. Otherwise, people can email me or rent the book.
Well, I take the question about internationalism to deal with Rawls again.
Rawls again.
And in fact, that your discussion of internationalism comes towards the end of your book. Rawls attempts to take his views into the international realm.
Yes.
And to talk about how they can bring about peace between, or you know, he hopes that they could bring peace between liberal and non-liberal but decent people, peoples in the world. Again, where metaphysical notions don't have to play a role in this kind of public discourse.
Well, they've got their metaphysical notions, right. but those are kind of bracketed. That's the way they live.
Right. So, please talk about.
Well, I'll talk about it very briefly, because I know we're running out of time. But again, this was an area where people saw a weakness in Rawls that he was speaking in a culture bound sort of way about mm-hmm. a particular kind of Western liberal society, and of course, if that's true. His book becomes much more descriptive and much less normative than it was often taken to be. If he's just talking about this is the way we do things, or this is the way we wish we do things, or something like that, that's not the same as what he got all the credit for doing. He wants to try and show that there's one doesn't have to be a Western Cambridge liberal in order to have good international relations. This is the international part corresponding to the intercultural part that he wanted to do in political liberalism. And he plays a test for himself. He proposes an imaginary society, which he calls Kazakhstan, and it's supposed to be a Muslim society, but one which has overcome a lot of the problems that bedevil Islam, problems about relations between the sexes and so forth. Although Rawls kind of tries to stay away from family relations. He seems to have a sense that his theory doesn't do very well. And a lot of feminists from Honora O'Neill and Jean Beth Gielstein and others criticized him for not talking about justice and fairness within the family. He imagines a kind of coming together in which there's another veil of ignorance, and the various societies get together, and people don't know what society they're going to belong to, and then you get a kind of acceptance of, as you rightly put it, non-liberal but decent societies. These non-liberal societies, they're hierarchical, all right. He doesn't use the word fascistic, but they're even fascistic in the sense that they have the rule of groups and communities being represented rather than individuals. And they're very hierarchical. He sort of sidesteps the question of whether those societies are whether there's cronyism going on, for example. He doesn't get into that. But, you know, in hegemonical, hierarchical societies, there often is a lot of nepotism, a lot of cronyism. He's sort of trying to sift and sort what would make a society acceptable as decent, but still definitely not liberal. It was in dealing with his treatment of that question that something became very, very clear to me about Rawls's method. And it affects not only law of peoples, but it affects theory of justice as well. And that is, his method is to pose a problem and then propose that the answer to it that he has proposed is the adequate answer to it. In other words, he winds up doing something that positivists always accused analysis, whether it was logical or mathematical or any other kind of analysis, of amounting to, that it always boils down to a tautology. In other words, he makes his argument circular. He's got a problem here. Can there be a hierarchical Islamic society which satisfies the standards of a decent community of peoples? He defines the standards of that decent community of peoples in such a way that the hierarchical imaginary society that he has envisioned, which he's also defined, will guaranteed to meet it, guaranteed to meet those standards. So he doesn't talk about Islam as it really is and the problems that it really has and that every serious Muslim is or should be concerned with. He talks about an imaginary Islamic society which by postulation meets the standards that are set for it by an imaginary community of nations, community of peoples, as he calls them. And it suddenly struck me, as I read that, that what he's doing is not political theory at all, certainly not normative political theory. What he's doing is mathematics. Okay. Yes, I know that there can be a version of Islam, an Islamic society that's run in the traditional way. Whether there's jihad in such a society or not, whether there's slavery or not, whether there's polygamy or not, we can bracket all those questions. Whatever the issues are, they're met by postulation. But real societies, and I don't want to pick on Islam here, real societies, every real society has real problems, and none of the problems of a real society are solved by postulate. They're solved by working and thinking together. The book leads you to a place which is a place of wishful thinking. I think it's a come down.
So great. Well, thank you for insisting on that question.
Let those who listen read the chapter and see if I'm right. And if I'm wrong, they can instruct me. As I said before, they can send me an email. I'll write a different book.
Well, thank you again for this conversation. And as listeners could tell, we're both struggling with coughs of one kind or another. So.
Yeah, I hope it wasn't too hacking.
I've been talking with Len Goodman, author of Religious Pluralism and Values in the Public Sphere, soon to be out, supposedly this month, I think,
from Cambridge
University Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. And as Len said, feel free to contact him as well. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.